6. "When are you going to tell us what you do know?" Eddie asked the next morning. The day was bright and blue, but there was a bite in the air. Their first autumn in this world was almost upon them. Roland glanced at him. "What do you mean?"
"I'd like to hear your whole story, from beginning to end, starting with Gilead. How you grew up there and what happened to end it all. I want to know how you found out about the Dark Tower and why you started chasing after it in the first place. I want to know about your first bunch of friends, too, and what happened to them."
Roland removed his hat, armed sweat from his brow, then replaced it. "You have the right to know all those things, I suppose, and I'll tell them to you, but not now. It's a very long story. I never expected to tell it to anyone, and I'll only tell it once."
"When?"
Eddie persisted. "When the time is right," Roland said, and with that they had to be content. 7. Roland came awake the moment before Jake began to shake him. He sat up and looked around, but Eddie and Susanna were still fast asleep, and in the first faint light of morning he could see nothing amiss. "What is it?" he asked Jake in a low voice.
"I don't know. Fighting, maybe. Come and listen."
Roland threw his blanket aside and followed Jake out to the road. He reckoned they were now only 3 days' walk from the place where the Send passed in front of the city, and the bridge, built squarely along the path of the beam, dominated the horizon. Its pronounced tilt was more clearly visible than ever, and he could see at least a dozen gaps where overstressed cables had snapped like the strings of a lyre. Tonight the wind blew directly into their faces as they looked toward the city, and the sounds it carried to them were faint but clear.
"Is it fighting?"
Jake asked. Roland nodded and held a finger to his lips. He heard faint shouts, a crash that sounded like some huge object falling, and, of course, the drums. Now there was another crash, this one more musical, the sound of breaking glass.
"Jeepers,"
Jake whispered and moved closer to the gunslinger. Then came the sounds which Roland had hoped not to hear, a fast, sandy rattle of small arms fire, followed by a loud, hollow bang, clearly an explosion of some kind. It rolled across the flatlands toward them like an invisible bowling ball. After that, the shouts, thuds, and sounds of breakage quickly sank below the level of the drums, and when the drums quit a few minutes later with their usual unsettling suddenness, the city was silent again. But now that silence had an unpleasant waiting quality. Roland put an arm around Jake's shoulders. "Still not too late to detour around," he said. Jake glanced up at him.
"We can't."
"Because of the train?" Jake nodded and sing-songed,
"Blaine is a pain, but we have to take the train. And the city's the only place where we can get on."
Roland looked thoughtfully at Jake. "Why do you say we have to? Is it Ka?" "Because, Jake, you have to understand that you don't know much about Ka yet. It's the sort of subject men study all their lives."
"I don't know if it's Ka or not, but I do know that we can't go into the wastelands unless we're protected, and that means Blaine. Without him, we'll die, like those bees we saw are going to die when winter comes. We have to be protected, because the wastelands are poison."
"How do you know these things?"
"I don't know," Jake said, almost angrily. "I just do."
"All right," Roland said mildly. He looked toward Lud again. "But we'll have to be damned careful. It's unlucky that they still have gunpowder. If they have that, they may have things that are even more powerful. I doubt if they know how to use them, but that only increases the danger. They could get excited and blow us all to hell."
"Hell!"
a grave voice said from behind them. They glanced around and saw Oi sitting by the side of the road watching them. 8. Later that day, they came to a new road which swept toward them out of the west and joined their own way. Beyond this point, the great road, now much wider and split down the middle by a median divider of some polished dark stone, began to sink, and the crumbling concrete embankments which rose on either side of them gave the pilgrims a claustrophobic, trapped feeling.
They stopped at a point where one of these concrete dikes had been broken open, affording a comforting line of sight to the open land beyond, and ate a light, unsatisfying meal.
"Why do you think they dropped the road down like this, Eddie?" Jake asked. "I mean, someone did do it this way on purpose, didn't they?"
Eddie looked through the break in the concrete where the flat land stretched on as smoothly as ever and nodded.
"Then why?"
"Dunno, champ," Eddie said, but he thought he did. He glanced at Roland and guessed that he knew, too. The sunken road leading to the bridge had been a defensive measure. Troops placed atop the concrete slopes were in control of two carefully engineered redoubts. If the defenders didn't like the look of the folks approaching Ludd along the Great Road, they could rain destruction down on them.
"You sure you don't know?" Jake asked.
Eddie smiled at Jake and tried to stop imagining that there was some nut up there right now getting ready to roll a large rusty bomb down one of those decayed concrete ramps.
"No idea," he said.
Susanna whistled disgustedly between her teeth.
"This road's going to hell, Roland. I was hoping we were done with that damn harness, but you better get it out again."
He nodded and rummaged in his purse for it without a word. The condition of the great road deteriorated as other smaller roads joined it like tributaries joining a great river. As they neared the bridge, the cobbles were replaced with a surface Roland thought of as metal and the rest of them thought of as asphalt or hot top. It had not held up as well as the cobbles. Time had done some damage. The passage of countless horses and wagons since the last repairs were made had done more. The surface had been chewed into a treacherous rubble. Foot travel would be difficult, and the idea of pushing Susanna's wheelchair over that crumbled surface was ridiculous. The banks on either side had grown steadily steeper, and now, at their tops, they could see slim, pointed shapes looming against the sky. Roland thought of arrowheads, huge ones, weapons made by a tribe of giants. To his companions, they looked like rockets or guided missiles. Susanna thought of redstones fired from Cape Canaveral. Eddie thought about Sam, some built to be fired from the backs of flatbed trucks stored all over Europe. Jake thought of ICBMs hiding in reinforced concrete silos under the plains of Kansas and the unpopulated mountains of Nevada, programmed to hit back at China or the USSR in the event of nuclear Armageddon. All of them felt as if they had passed into a dark and woeful zone of shadow, or into a countryside laboring under some old but still powerful curse. Some hours after they entered this area, Jake called it the Gauntlet, the concrete embankments ended at a place where half a dozen access roads drew together like the strands of a spider web, and here the land opened out again, a fact which relieved all of them, although none of them said so out loud. Another traffic light swung over the junction. This one was more familiar to Eddie, Susanna, and Jake. It had once had lenses on its four faces, although the glass had been broken out long ago.
"I'll bet this road was the eighth wonder of the world once upon a time," Susanna said. "And look at it now, it's a minefield."
"Old ways are sometimes the best ways," Roland agreed. Eddie was pointing west.
"Look!"
Now that the high concrete barriers were gone, they could see exactly what old Cy had described to them over cups of bitter coffee in River Crossing.
"One track only," he had said, "set up high on a column of man-made stone, such as the old ones used to make their streets and walls."
The track raced toward them out of the west in a slim, straight line, then flowed across the Send and into the city on a narrow, golden trestle. It was a simple, elegant construction, and the only one they had seen so far which was totally without rust, but it was badly marred all the same. Halfway across, a large piece of the trestle had fallen into the rushing river below. What remained were two long, jutting piers that pointed at each other like accusing fingers. Jutting out of the water below the hole was a streamlined tube of metal. Once it had been bright blue, but now the color had been dimmed by spreading scales of rust. It looked very small from this distance.
"So much for Blaine," Eddie said. "No wonder they stopped hearing it. The supports finally gave way while it was crossing the river, and it fell in the drink. It must have been decelerating when it happened, or it would have carried straight across, and all we'd see would be a big hole like a bomb crater in the far bank. Well, it was a great idea while it lasted."
"Mercy said there was another one," Susanna reminded him.
Yeah, she also said she hadn't heard it in 7 or 8 years. And Aunt Talitha said it was more like 10. What do you think, Jake? Jake? Earth to Jake, Earth to Jake. Come in, little buddy.
Jake, who had been staring intently at the remains of the train in the river, only shrugged.
You're a big help, Jake, Eddie said. Valuable input. That's why I love you. Why we all love you.
Jake paid no attention. He knew what he was seeing, and it wasn't Blaine. The remains of the mono sticking out of the river were blue. In his dream, Blaine had been the dusty, sugary pink of the bubblegum you got with baseball trading cards. Roland, meanwhile, had cinched the straps of Susanna's carry harness across his chest. Eddie, boost your lady into this contraption. It's time we moved on and saw for ourselves. Jake now shifted his gaze, looking nervously toward the bridge looming ahead. He could hear a high, ghostly humming noise in the distance, the sound of the wind playing in the decayed steel hangars which connected the overhead cables to the concrete deck below.
"Do you think it'll be safe to cross?" Jake asked.
"We'll find out tomorrow," Roland replied. 9. The next morning, Roland's band of travelers stood at the end of the long, rusty bridge, gazing across at Ludd. Eddie's dreams of wise old elves who had preserved a working technology in which the pilgrims could draw were disappearing. Now that they were this close, he could see holes in the cityscape, where whole blocks of buildings appeared to have been either burned or blasted. The skyline reminded him of a diseased jaw from which many teeth have already fallen. It was true that most of the buildings were still standing, but they had a dreary, disused look that filled Eddie with an uncharacteristic gloom. And the bridge between the travelers and that shuttered maze of steel and concrete looked anything but solid and eternal. The vertical hangars on the left sagged slackly, the ones remaining on the right almost screamed with tension. The deck had been constructed of hollow concrete boxes shaped like trapezoids. Some of these had buckled upward, displaying empty black interiors, others had slipped askew. Many of these latter had merely cracked, but others were badly broken, leaving gaps big enough to drop trucks, big trucks, into. In places where the bottoms of the box sections, as well as the tops, had shattered, they could see the muddy riverbank and the gray-green water of the Send beyond it. Eddie put the distance between the deck and the water as 300 feet at the center of the bridge, and that was probably a conservative estimate. Eddie peered at the huge concrete caissons to which the main cables were anchored, and thought the one on the right side of the bridge looked as if it had been pulled partway out of the earth. He decided he might do well not to mention this fact to the others. It was bad enough that the bridge was swaying slowly but perceptibly back and forth. Just looking at it made him feel seasick.
"Well," he asked Roland, "what do you think?"
Roland pointed to the right side of the bridge. Here was a canted walkway about 5 feet wide. It had been constructed atop a series of smaller concrete boxes and was in effect a separate deck. This segmented deck appeared to be supported by an undercable, or perhaps it was a thick steel rod, anchored to the main support cables by huge bow clamps. Eddie inspected the closest one with the avid interest of a man who may soon be entrusting his life to the object he is studying. The bow clamp appeared rusty but still sound. The words "La Merck Foundry" had been stamped into its metal. Eddie was fascinated to realize he no longer knew if the words were in the high speech or in English.
"I think we can use that," Roland said. "There's only one bad place. Do you see it?"
"Yeah, it's kind of hard to miss." The bridge, which had to be at least 3/4 of a mile long, might not have had any proper maintenance for over 1,000 years, but Roland guessed that the real destruction might have been going on for only the last 50 or so. As the hangars on the right snapped, the bridge had listed farther and farther to the left. The greatest twist had occurred in the center of the bridge between the 2 400-foot cable towers. At the place where the pressure of the twist was the greatest, a gaping, eye-shaped hole ran across the deck. The break in the walkway was narrower, but even so, at least 2 adjoining concrete box sections had fallen into the Send, leaving a gap at least 20 or 30 feet wide. Where these boxes had been, they could clearly see the rusty steel rod or cable which supported the walkway. They would have to use it to get across the gap.
"I think we can cross," Roland said, calmly pointing.
The gap is inconvenient, but the side rail is still there, so we'll have something to hold on to. Eddie nodded, but he could feel his heart pounding hard. The exposed walkway support looked like a big pipe made of jointed steel and was probably 4 feet across at the top. In his mind's eye, he could see how they would have to edge across, feet on the broad, slightly curved back of the support, hands clutching the rail, while the bridge swayed slowly like a ship in a mild swell. "Jesus," he said. He tried to spit, but nothing came out. His mouth was too dry.
"You sure, Roland?"
"So far as I can see, it's the only way." Roland pointed downriver, and Eddie saw a second bridge. This one had fallen into the Seine long ago. The remains stuck out of the water in a rusted tangle of ancient steel.
"What about you, Jake?" Susanna asked.
"Hey, no problem," Jake said at once. He was actually smiling.
"I hate you, kid," Eddie said.
Roland was looking at Eddie with some concern. "If you feel you can't do it, say so now. Don't get halfway across and then freeze up." Eddie looked along the twisted surface of the bridge for a long time, then nodded.
"I guess I can handle it. Heights have never been my favorite thing, but I'll manage."
"Good." Roland surveyed them. "Soonest begun, soonest done. I'll go first with Susanna, then Jake and Eddie's drogue. Can you handle the wheelchair?"
"Hey, no problem," Eddie said giddily.
"Let's go then." 10. As soon as he stepped onto the walkway, fear filled up Eddie's hollow places like cold water, and he began to wonder if he hadn't made a very dangerous mistake. From solid ground, the bridge seemed to be swaying only a little, but once he was actually on it, he felt as if he were standing on the pendulum of the world's biggest grandfather clock. The movement was very slow, but it was regular, and the length of the swings was much longer than he had anticipated. The walkway's surface was badly cracked and canted at least 10 degrees to the left. His feet gritted in loose piles of powdery concrete, and the low squealing sound of the box segments grinding together was constant. Beyond the bridge, the city skyline tilted slowly back and forth, like the artificial horizon of the world's slowest-moving video game. Overhead, the wind hummed constantly in the taut hangars. Below, the ground fell away sharply to the muddy northwest bank of the river. He was 30 feet up, then 60, then 110. Soon he would be over the water. The wheelchair banged against his left leg with every step. Something furry brushed between his feet, and he clutched madly for the rusty handrail with his right hand, barely holding in a scream. Oi went trotting past him with a brief upward glance as if to say, "Excuse me, just passing."
"Fucking dumb animal," Eddie said through gritted teeth.
He discovered that although he didn't like looking down, he had an even greater aversion to looking at the hangars, which were still managing to hold the deck and the overhead cables together. They were sleeved with rust, and Eddie could see snarls of metal thread poking out of most. These snarls looked like metallic puffs of cotton. He knew from his Uncle Reg, who had worked on both the George Washington and Triborough bridges as a painter, that the hangers and overhead cables were spun from thousands of steel threads. On this bridge, the spin was finally letting go. The hangers were quite literally becoming unraveled, and as they did, the threads were snapping, one interwoven strand at a time.
"It's held this long, it'll hold a little longer. You think this thing's going to fall into the river just because you're crossing it? Don't flatter yourself."
He wasn't comforted, however. For all Eddie knew, they might be the first people to attempt the crossing in decades. And the bridge, after all, would have to collapse sometime. And from the look of things, it was going to be soon. Their combined weight might be the straw that broke the camel's back. His moccasin struck a chunk of concrete, and Eddie watched, sickened but helpless to look away, as the chunk fell down and down and down, turning over as it went. There was a small, very small, splash when it hit the river. The freshening wind gusted and stuck his shirt against his sweaty skin. The bridge groaned and swayed. Eddie tried to remove his hands from the side rail, but they seemed frozen to the pitted metal in a death grip. He closed his eyes for a moment.
"You're not going to freeze. You're not.
I forbid it. If you need something to look at, make it long, tall, and ugly.
Eddie opened his eyes again, fixed them on the gunslinger, forced his hands to open, and began to move forward again.